Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all of the previous episodes of Feast Your Ears can be found at the archives of heritageradionetwork.org. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I'd like it if you'd leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. My guest today, we'll jump right in, is Maddie Matheson. Maddie, thank you so much for joining me here today on this rainy Monday, Columbus Day, in the studio in Bushwick. Most of you listening to this network, I'm sure, know who Maddie is. He is the host on Viceland of Dead Set on Life, It's Supper Time, Keep It Canada. He's the author of a new wonderful cookbook that comes out tomorrow called Maddie Matheson, a cookbook. I have a copy sitting here. He's the chef at Parts and Labor in Toronto.
No,
not anymore.
No, I left like a year ago.
Oh, well, you were the chef.
I was the chef.
Okay. Who's the chef now?
Ben Dakin.
Sorry, Ben.
Good guy.
If you're ever in New York, Ben, I'd love to have you on the show.
Ben's great.
Well, Maddie, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me, man.
We were talking a little bit before the show, you have managed to create a career out of being you. And yeah. You have gotten a lot of notoriety out of that. And I feel like there are people who become famous because they're celebrities, right? And they play other people on TV and yeah. They kind of get to be themselves, but not always, right? People get, yeah. I mean, Jeff Goldblum is always going to be the fly.
Jeff Goldblum will always be the fly. Yeah, man.
Right?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think that from day one, I was just being me.
Yeah.
And the shows and the internet stuff and all that stuff did well enough that it got me to a certain point, and now I'm in a position of I can just be me. Yeah. Luckily, you know, like I think it's like there is a persona, like a lot of people come up to me and they're like, why aren't you yelling? I'm like, because I'm standing here talking to you. Yeah, right. I'm not like on camera yelling about some fucking stupid food thing.
Sure.
And it's just that's the one annoying thing where people are like, do something crazy. I'm like, when have I ever done actually something crazy?
Right.
Actually, like that's yeah. the thing that I think I'm like, I'm just kind of loud and have a personality. Yeah. I'm like, I don't think anything is crazy or like hectic. I don't know. I'm just me, man. And I think it's I'm just excited right now that I can kind of just be me and always kind of be me. And if people don't like that, that's fine. If people like that, that's chill.
I mean, I commend you for it. I was watching, I remember watching the Keep It Canada episode where you're up and you're playing golf in the beginning and you're with your friend who's got the barbecue place.
Yeah.
And then you go and you guys kill a lamb. And that's like not, I mean, like if when people come up to you on the street and they say do something crazy, like that's not crazy. That's intense. And it's something that you do and it's something that you'd never done before.
Yeah, it was really intense. I've never slaughtered an animal of that size. Like that was like probably a 120-pound lamb. Yeah. And that like it was real.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I commend you for that. I mean, that's, you know, that the show has those things where I guess what, you know, the parts that people think of, I guess, is like, you know, you're a guy who in the past was known for your partying and you're covered in tattoos and you're a big personality and you guys go out on his boat and you shoot a shotgun for the first time and you're doing all these fun stuff, the things that are firsts, but that's also what life is about, right? Mm. Like, I went swimming this morning in a pond in Rhode Island. It's the first time I've ever been swimming in October, right? Yeah. Like, that's a first.
That's a good first.
But you're doing those things in front of the camera because you can. And you have the opportunity to go visit your friends and sort of do those things. But they're not all crazy.
No, they aren't crazy. And that's the thing. I always find it very funny. I don't know. I just think that maybe that shows how boring everything is. That I'm the if I'm the crazy one, I'm like, motherfuckers better get out there on TV and start doing some shit. Because there's a lot of amazing people out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just find it really funny that I'm like the wild card.
Yeah. I mean, but, you know, I think that it's, I mean, it's good that you're out there doing that stuff. And I think it's great that you have a platform to, you know, present, I mean, in all honesty, like to me as an American, right?
Yeah.
All these things about Canada that I never would have known about. I mean, that's really cool. And
well,
that's
I don't think Americans know a lot about a lot of things.
Well, we don't know a lot about anything, ultimately. We really but y'all don't. Do. I mean, today's called Columbus Day, right? It shouldn't be. I mean, it's some pretty dark shit.
Columbus is fucked.
Yeah. We stopped on the way down here and showed our kids the Narragansett Indian Church this morning.
There you go.
And talked about the Narragansett Indian tribe in Rhode Island.
There you go.
Talk about, like, look at here's what Columbus did.
Yeah, kids. Took it. They took it. They took it all. And now we're here on a radio station.
So I want to talk about the TV shows a little bit.
Okay.
You know, where do you guys film It's Supper Time?
It's Supper Time was filmed in a food. We
it's
built
just a studio.
Yeah, it's just a studio. We built it. Literally, our only reference. I was just like, I want it to look like, you know. And this will sound shitty now because Roseanne's a racist idiot. But I was just like, I just want it to look like, you know, Roseanne's kitchen.
Right.
Just like a normal, like the kitchen I grew up in, like linoleum floors, just like kind of gaudy.
Yep.
You know, like a working class kind of kitchen, a little bright because it needs to be a little bit light. And yeah, like that was it. And we just shot it like in Toronto in a food studio. We built it. It's just, you know, three walls.
Yeah. And it comes off that way. I mean, to be perfectly honest, it reminded me of what it must have been like when people first started watching Julia Child. Because she was in her kitchen, essentially, and the set was effectively a copy of her kitchen.
Yeah.
And it was just her cooking, and she screwed stuff up. She dropped things on the floor, and she was really trying to make it accessible, I think, to people who weren't really cooking at home, although her focus was French cooking, right? But I love that you are trying to get people to understand that, like, even if you don't have, like, the fresh tomatoes growing in your garden, you should still be making your tomato sauce instead of buying
I think
it.
People need to cook.
Of course.
I think the biggest, and I've said this kind of before, like my brothers, you know, I got two brothers and a sister, and my brothers don't know how to fucking cook. And that freaks me out kind of. And it always did where like I would, like when I went to cooking school, like in 2000, I would go and visit my brothers. They lived together in a house. And I would go there and like they would eat cereal. And I'm just like, because they don't know how to fucking cook. And I was just like, and that kind of spooked me out. And I just think that we need food. And I think it brings me such like joy and happiness to cook food. And it's literally, there's not a lot of honest things in the world. And I think food is one of those things that builds self-esteem and builds character. And you can share that with people. And it's not easy, but if you do it enough, you'll get good at it, and you'll just get. And the thing that I always say too is like everyone needs like just a few of your own little dishes that you can make, and you got those things, and you feel really good. Like you're like, oh, I make this one refried bean dish. I make this one lasagna. I make this one salad. I make a salad dressing, even as simple as that. And like that person knows that they can do something well, and I think that cooking is a really great platform to build self-esteem and character. And I think like that shit goes a long way, and I don't know. I just truly love food.
So what led you down the path of cooking and them down the path of cereal?
Well, there's no path of cereal. Cereal can suck my dick. But the path of food was it like I paint this kind of romantic picture in my cookbook of like my grandfather having a restaurant and growing up and going there and like seeing restaurants at a very young age and sleeping in like the booths of the, you know, like the old soda pop shop and waking up early because they would open up at 6 a.m. for truckers and, you know, having this amazing experience with restaurants from a very early age. But I never thought of it as a restaurant. It was just Grampy's house kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's just the Blue Goose. And, And then I never really thought about food. I never cooked a lot. We always had good food growing up. It was just going... The thing that got me into cooking professionally or going to cooking school was just I wanted to move to Toronto. That was it. I wanted to move to the city. Yeah. I lived in Fort Erie, small border town, fucking full of stupid people, you know, which is funny now because I moved back there. And I mean, it's beautiful.
Roots are strong, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, it is. It's kind of crazy. But like my wife is from there and her family's there. And you can buy a lot of property for still pretty cheap. Sure. And it's amazing. But the thing that got me to food was just the urge of getting out of my city, going to the big city. You know, just they had a punk scene. Like it was just because I grew up next to Buffalo. So like going to hardcore shows and punk shows was like everything. That was the only thing I really cared about, truly. At that time, like in high school, it was the only thing I cared about was like hardcore shows. And then my parents were like, well, you have to go to college. And the only school I got accepted to was a cooking school because you just have to pay. Right. Like, it's not like fucking Harvard or Yale or I don't know, even know these, like UFT or like any of these like prestigious like Ryerson.
You don't have to test in.
Yeah, I didn't have to go do a fucking interview. I just had to sign up and pay. And I was like, oh, I got in. And I just wanted to go to the city, and my means of getting to the city was going to cooking school because I was not an academic. I was like literally had to have like beg my principal or my vice principal, like Mrs. Barchese, just to be like, yo, like, just get me through this shit. I'll be gone. Get me out of high school. I don't give a fuck about any of this. Like, get me out. You hate me. I hate you. Right. Like, let's shake hands and get me the fuck out of high school. And I want to go to college though, because I want to go get out of this fucking town. And then I just went to cooking school. And then when I went to cooking school, it was the first time that I ever got good, and I kind of talk about this as well. Like, it was the first time I ever got like good grades. So then in cooking school, I was like, oh, if I put on like chef whites and show up on time and make a bouillabaisse, I get good grades. Cool. I have great, you know, probably above average knife skills at that moment. Right. I was just very comfortable with knives and all that kind of stuff, and you know, I didn't find it difficult to like butcher a rabbit or, you know, like it was just like these things that I was just like, oh, cooking school's chill, easy. Just you had to be there. And it was college. So I was like fucked up all the time. Yeah. And the hardest part was getting there on time. And I had 8 a.m. classes every day and you had to be there. The chef, my one main chef, Bevan, Anthony Bevan, he would lock the door at 7:45. So like you had to be there like 20 minutes before. But, you know, that's the one thing. The one thing that I really learned from cooking school was, like, some fundamental shit. But, like, being on time for things was, like, the big... Like, that's really stuck with me.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's important. It's important to be on time. If you tell someone you're going to be somewhere...
Yeah. I hate... You know? It's just people that are late, I feel like, choose to be late.
Yeah.
It's, like, never... It's never the subway.
Right.
It's you left 10 minutes late, and the subway was... as the regular time, but you still left like 10 minutes late and you're blaming something else and you're lazy.
I will say in the 20 years I've lived in New York, the subways have gotten worse. So sometimes now, 20 years ago, I don't think it was
the subway.
I've only
been on the subway once in New York in my life.
Now I think it actually could be the subway and you could get a little more leeway as far as that. But I agree with you.
Yeah. People that can't be somewhere on time, I just feel like that's the bare minimum. If you can't do that, then get the fuck away from me.
And did Trish move with you? Because you guys have been together, your wife. You guys have been together since high school, right?
Yeah, we've been together. She asked me to prom. You know, she's lucky, that one. She is a lucky one to have me. But resilience. A lot of resilience. But
did she move to Toronto with you when you went to cooking
school? No. So she went to London. She went for fashion merchandising. Yeah, I think she went for like a fashion course at a school called Fanshawe out in London, Ontario, which is about 2.5 hours from Toronto. So we had like a long distance relationship for about 2.5-3 years. And then we'd see each other like, I don't know, twice a month. I'd go there for a one weekend. She'd come see me, you know, take a lot of bus rides. And then when she graduated, she moved to Toronto because I wasn't like going to move to London, Ontario.
Right, you went to Toronto because you wanted to be in the city.
Yeah, so she moved up there in like 2003. And then,
cool. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors here at Heritage Radio Network. And when we come back, I want to talk about tour.
Sure.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com. The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I'm joined in the studio today by Maddie Matheson, if you're just tuning in. And before the break, we were talking about Toronto and hardcore and cooking and food. So now, going back to kind of like the rock and roll life, you're on tour.
On tour now.
Here. Started last night, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
Tonight, New York City.
Yo, Pittsburgh was amazing. I loved, you know, this whole thing is really funny. Just touring, you know, I think the way that we used to tour and back in the day, just like being like a shitty punk band or hardcore band or indie band. I used to tour with a few different kinds of bands.
Yeah, you get in a van with
your
buddies.
Yeah, you get in a van with some buddies
with a bunch of
like
smelly
not enough clothes,
and crap, and
no money. Literally no money and no food, and you drive across the world.
Yep.
And you know, there's no showering, there's no nothing. Wet sleeping bags, sleeping on people's floors,
flat tires, breaking down,
stealing food from gas stations, eating a lot of like peanut butter, and
so that's not the tour for your cookbook.
No, yesterday it was funny. I was like on tour. I was like first day of tour. I'm like sitting in the first seat on an airplane, flying to Pittsburgh, and then I'm just like flying from state to state, and it's very different. You know. A lot less cool, I feel. I wish I was with all my buddies, but, you know, I'm just out here solo, bouncing around on a plane, going to different states and doing some fun events, you know? Yeah.
So tell me about the event. So last night in Pittsburgh, you guys, there was a dinner.
Yeah,
right,
it was just
Ace
a giant dinner.
Like 100
it was like,
and something people.
Yeah, like 170 something people. And then like a bunch of people came after. And it was in this amazing gymnasium that like looked something out of like Shawshank Redemption. And it was just like an amazing dinner. And then like I talked for a little bit and just talked about the cookbook, very thankful for everyone coming. And I'm just always blown away. Like I'm just, all this shit is very new and weird. And I'm just like a very normal person, I feel. And, you know, I came out of the elevator at the hotel and literally everyone started like smiling and waving at me and like gasping kind of and like kind of freaking out a bit. And it's very weird. I like turned around and like walked in the opposite direction of everyone, and it's very weird like when you're like the thing that everyone's there to see.
Yeah.
And because it's not like a performance. It's not like you get on stage and you play and you leave and you go in your van and you fuck off. It's very much like, oh, you're just in a room with a bunch of people and you have to talk to, like, I took a photo with every single person, talked to every single person. I literally stood at the front and like shook everyone's hand as they walked in. Then I took photos with like pretty much every single person, wrote in their cookbooks, said what's up, talked to them and listened to them. And it's an amazing thing. It's a lot of patience and a lot of like being, it's very humbling, you know. Just being a kid from, you know, I still think of myself as like a kid from Canada,
right?
And which I am, but it's like, it's a wild experience just doing, even having a cookbook is wild. Like, I remember I was talking to like my old sous chef, Matt, like one of my best friends, And I remember we were sitting there 8 years ago, and we were like, imagine. It was like right when like the Joe Beef cookbook came out. Sure. And we're like, imagine like if we like had a cookbook. I remember like Dave and Fred had, when Instagram first started, I remember they put up a photo of them like in the woods with like Danielle Ballou.
Yep.
And we were just like, imagine hanging out with Danielle Ballou. And then I'm like, oh, I hang out, I can text Danielle. Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, like it's crazy how small the world has become.
As a slight tangent, it's funny that you bring up those guys at Joe Beef. The image that is burned into my brain from their Instagram account is one that I feel like they put up every like year or so of someone with an oyster knife through their finger.
Yeah, that's a good
that one.
That
one is burned into my brain Instagram feed.
That's a wild one.
It's like that's a PSA right there about being careful opening your oysters.
Oyster knives are gnarly. Yeah. Shucking oysters can be stressful. But
it's also a ton of work. And it's a ton of work with a kid. And you guys, I mean, you just moved, right? Just before you left for tour.
I'm still moving in.
Second baby's about to come any minute.
Yeah, she's due any I'm literally gonna hopefully not cancel any shows. But like everyone I'm doing the tour with, like knows like if I get the phone call, I'm like pulling the plug.
Right.
And
and I'm sure that the day the book was going to come out was planned so long ago, long before you guys knew you were having another kid.
Yeah, the book coming out date was probably a year ago. So it was like before we knew we were gonna, before Trish found out she was pregnant.
Yeah.
And
do you know what you're having? This time
we're having a baby girl.
Another a girl.
Cool. Yeah, so we got a boy. Yeah, we got a boy and a
collect
girl.
Them all.
We got Mac. Yeah, all we need is a dog. Yeah. But it's chill. Like it's just amazing to have that support of Trish being like most wives would freak out and be like, "What the fuck? You're not going?" And I'm like, "No, I'm gonna go." And when the second that plug drops, you fucking blow my horn, and I'll be here as soon as possible.
Yep.
The reason that I'm actually probably the most chill is because of Trish being like such a supportive wife and partner and mother, and just holds shit down so hard that I don't have to even think about the happiness of my family or anything like that, you know, kind of thing. Like, she doesn't give me shit, you know? She gives me shit all the time, but, you know, like, she just fucking holds it down and where I can go and do my thing, and that's how we support our family.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, like, the major reason that I'm so chill is because I just know that, you know, my partner is so just rock solid.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So, you know, some people who follow you may know that you had some health issues related to heavy drug and alcohol use in the past.
Yeah.
And some years ago got sober.
Yeah.
And, you know, so do you go to meetings on the road, like when you're on the road? Are you like, is that...
Yeah.
I mean, some, you know, some people do, some people don't. Like, I've known people that go and they have someone with them who's a buddy who is sober. You know what I mean? Like, stuff like that.
Yeah, like, I have a lot of people that I check in with all the time and friends. And, I go to a meeting whenever I can.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And, you know, a lot of meeting, like, sometimes it's just time doesn't permit.
Right.
Like, you know, like, I flew into Pittsburgh yesterday. Took a shower, did the event, woke up at 5:30, took a taxi to the airport, came to New York, have been doing things all day today, tomorrow, you know, like it is about, you know, I'm good. I check in with people when I'm not good and do the things I need to do to, you know.
But for sure.
I just live, you know, in that 24-hour period, man.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it was interesting to hear, you know, that at Feast this year, there was the zero-proof dinner.
Yeah.
That I thought was really cool. that a couple of chefs put together.
Was that with like Zimmern and Solomonov and all those dates?
Yep. Yeah. They did a dinner and had no alcohol served, and it wasn't, you know, that wasn't like, I don't feel like that was the point, but I think we're in this interesting time, and maybe it's because I'm getting older and I don't close bars anymore. I haven't in a couple of years, and you know, it's not as big a part of my life, but there are nights. I mean, when I was in my 20s, there were no nights that I didn't drink, right? And I'll go a week and I won't have a drink at all. Yeah. And it's not like it's that important a part. I can still make delicious food. I can eat delicious food. I can go out to dinner with people. You can do it all. And so it's interesting to see that there are chefs who are now on that side of things. I wonder, as someone who's been on both sides of it, do you think that there is still a place for like the kitchen confidential style kitchen in the modern restaurant?
I think that they for sure still exist.
No, of course they exist. But I feel like there was a time where that was like...
I think that was the only thing I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I wanted to be the minus... Well, in case you're, like, minus fucking everyone, right. You know? Right. Because I was always with my wife and I wasn't a creeper, you know? It's funny that I'm like... I'm lucky that I wasn't like a piece of shit. But I'm like, oh, it's just... being a good person. But the fucking all I wanted was I romanticized so deeply about being, I wanted to be like, I do more coke than you, I drink harder than you, I cook harder than you, I did more covers than you, I can prep faster than you, I can fucking do whatever I need to do, and I didn't sleep last night, and I drank 50 beers, and I did fucking an 8-ball, and I fucking, you know, it's just this weird fucking thing. And I think that a lot of it's bred in it, especially I think my generation is kind of the end of it, maybe. I know, like, even like some of my younger sous chefs are definitely just into like running and being healthy and sure. Like all this other shit where I'm like, I don't even get it. Like every Saturday night I just buy all my cooks like coke and like be like, let's party,
right?
And you know, things change a lot, and I think but I think it like comes from like, like the first restaurant I ever worked at was we had a club called the Man Club, and we would get fucked up, and there was girls in it too, but it was called the Man Club, and we would burn each other with there's one there, I have like a one that I tattooed over, but we used to burn each other just with like hot knives. And
you don't have a TR, do you?
Yeah. So. But the no, like, it's just, like, this weird thing. Like, we're just psychos. Restaurants are, like, literally, every cliche is real.
Yeah.
Sadly. And, you know, it's just, it is what it is, but it's, like, I think it's changing. I truly think it is changing. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think it's an amazing change.
Yeah.
And, you know, for as crazy, like, the thing that is amazing about the restaurants I worked in, they were always way more, like, bohemian than bro. You know, like where it was like the excess came from like culture and like came from like just being like Samuel Beckett slummy vibes rather than like we're fucking
beer bongs.
And, yeah, beer bongs and partying. Like I worked in like just French restaurants where everyone drank a lot of fucking wine and did cocaine and
Red Baudelaire.
Yeah, like we would go to like Chris Taylor Wright. Like we would, this one guy was the coolest. Like I went to his apartment and it was just like 1 million Matus bottles with candles and like like the first time I really ever heard like John Coltrane, you know, like it was just like stuff that like we would go there and he would just like smoke. He never did drugs, he always just drank, but he would just sit there and like smoke cigarettes and we would just talk about art and records and we would sit there and I would just like shovel coke in my face. And he lived in like a loft, which is like kind of rare in Toronto. Like there's no like Brooklyn-esque places, you know, like Toronto's still like a smaller city. So he had this like insane like apartment in Chinatown and all this kind of stuff. But like, I think like the excess came from like that. And then I think, and I just always, because I am a psychopathic, selfish person, I always did more than I could, you know, I always wanted more.
Right.
That's all. And then I stopped.
Yeah.
That's it. Like really, you know, like I just like, I got a little bit older, a little bit crazier, had a heart attack, had some other shit happen. You know, was going to lose everything. Probably, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, everyone said I was going to lose everything. And I got to the point where I thought I was actually going to lose everything. And then I was like, okay, And then, you know, wrap
and
it
that
up.
Led, and that led you here, right? It led you to the book. It led, I mean, yeah, there's a lot, you know, it's all aligned,
what,
right?
The things that I've done in the last 5 years are way crazier and way more amazing than anything that I did back in the day, riding my bike around Kensington Market, doing coke till 8 a.m.
Yeah.
You know, like, really.
Yeah. Tell me about Chef Rang.
Chef Rang.
I mean,
Chef Rang
appears in your shows. He appears in your Instagram.
It's
funny.
The real story. You want to hear the real story?
Well, sure.
No, it is. You know, Rang was my chef, pretty much. Like, Rang was the chef of, like, Le Select, Master Rang. Nobody called him Chef Rang. Everyone called him Master Rang, and he had to answer to fucking Master Rang. And, like, Brad Clark was the chef, but he was, like, one of those chefs that did, like, he was, like, daytime kind of chef. So Rang ran the fucking kitchen at night, and he was a crazy, amazing chef, and he was a hard ass. He taught me how to work a fucking line. He taught me how to fucking prep and set my station up on time, and to cook a lot of fucking French food at really quickly and, you know, efficiently. And he's an amazing guy and has an amazing story. Like,
there's
like,
an intense episode
the thing
where
it was just, you know, like to learn how to cook French food from a Vietnamese refugee who was brought up in Newfoundland by multiple abusive, like, foster families, being the only, everyone used to call him just Chinese,
yeah.
Chinese person in Newfoundland. Everyone just called him Chink. And to come through all that literally from a boat that he stole with a bunch of kids in Newfoundland when he was 10 fucking years old, and to survive all that and then champion the world and to be running one of the most greatest French bistros in Canada. He was the guy running that shit. And, you know, like, that's a lot. And I think, like, that, and me and him got really close. We became very, very close. And then we, you know, he was like just a big brother. We were like brothers. He was like a big brother to me by the end of it. You know, we worked together every single day fucking for 3 years. And then I left Le Select. And we kind of drifted apart as people do, because you only know, like, if you're working in the restaurants, you only hang out really with the people in your restaurant. And it's very, very, I don't know. It's just very crew mentality where you only literally hang out with the people in your restaurant most of the time. And then we kind of drifted apart. And then when I started doing all the Vice stuff, and we were like, let's do some stuff. Like, we were working on, like, Dead Set on Life. And Patrick, one of the guys at Vice, was like, hey, do you have, like, a person, like, a weird person that you know that really knows you well that you could, like, bring? And I was like, I know this, like, crazy weird old Vietnamese guy who used to be my chef. And I haven't spoke to him in, like, maybe, like, a year, you know? And I could call him up and see if he'd want to come. And then that's really, like, how it happened. Like, where it was just, like, I hadn't really spoke to Rang in a while. Like, I'd see him, like, once a year. We'd kind of get together, have some drinks, kind of talk about the old days, you know? Like,
yeah.
Because we drifted apart. Like, that's, like,
sure.
We stopped working together in, like, 2004.
Yeah.
So, so we kind of drifted away. Always friends, but just we never had, like, a weird breakup or anything like that. And then we just got back together. And then he became on Dead Set on Life. And, you know, he's been on a few episodes of Dead Set on Life. And it's supper time. And, you know, the greatest thing from all of my television stuff that I've done is, like, Rang has been on, like, I don't know, 6 episodes maybe. And his whole life has changed. Like, when he was just working at Le Select, and then he left Le Select and he was working at, like, Le Paradis, this other French bistro in Toronto. And now he, like, does personal chef gigs, gets paid a lot of money. People fucking love him. And, you know, he's got money. And, like, that's the thing that like, I'm a survivor and so is he.
Yep.
And I think, you know, but he was, you know, making, what, $17 an hour, being a chef at, like, a French bistro where the menu hasn't changed in 25 years. And, you know, you're serving the same old fucking, like, shitty pistolet de air, some fucking frisée lardon bullshit. And now he goes and cooks at like the richest people's houses in like Muskoka, which is like the richest cottage country. And like everyone just wants Ryan to come and cook. And he cooks like the same shit. The funniest thing, I want to put him on blast, but like the funniest thing, he cooks like the same shit at everyone's house. He cooks like beef tenderloin and like fucking shrimps and lamb chops and lobsters. And he cooks the same fucking shit. That, and it's funny, like all the sides that he always cooks with these people is like all the old Le Select shit. And I always put like the way he makes his ratatouille is like the same. It's very funny when I see stuff. I'm like, he makes like the same like sun-dried tomato vinaigrette that we used to make fucking 20 years ago for lamb chops. And I'm just like, bro, you don't have to make sun-dried tomato vinaigrette for lamb chops. Or like, it's just like a funny, like he's such a sweetie, man. And that's the thing, like that's the greatest thing that has come from that. And the craziest thing too, literally like the Oprah moment, we got a fucking email from a kid and him and his mom live in like DC. And this kid is like, I think my mom was on that boat with Ryan.
Wow.
And the producers connected Ryan and this woman, and she was one of the kids on that fucking boat.
Amazing.
And because they got the boat was out on the water for a couple days. It got picked up by like some fishermen by Malaysia. They got brought to Malaysia. Fucking all the kids got split up into refugee camps, and then right. They got sent all over the world.
Sure, and had no way to contact each
other. No, yeah, they were just kids. And Rang had this crazy phone call with this woman, or a few phone calls, I believe. And just to have that, they were from this small village called Kana, in the maybe possibly the birthplace of fish sauce.
Oh, wow.
And which is an amazing kind of story about Kana. And it's just wild. And like that stuff is like just that. Is such an amazing thing. And that's like the real shit. Where like me being a funny guy and like jumping on a horse and shooting a fucking crossbow and like, you know, field dressing a moose, like all that stuff is cool. But like that is like something real, something that changed literally one of my best friend's lives.
Yep.
And, you know, for him to get kind of a career and to make a fair bit of money is something that like is the sickest thing ever.
It's awesome. Super cool. So we're just about out of time, but I want to know, like, what do you see? I mean, obviously what's next for you is that you're about to have another kid and you're going to finish up this tour, but do you like, is it more TV? Do you ever see yourself going back in the kitchen?
Yeah. Well, I'm opening a restaurant. I'm opening up, like, I'm going to try to open up like the best, obviously everyone says like, yeah, I'm trying to open up like an amazing restaurant.
Yeah.
So I'm opening a restaurant in Toronto, hopefully May, June. I got this cookbook out. I'm trying to focus on just making my own content, putting it up on YouTube for everyone.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what needs to happen. I find TV is extremely finicky and you're only as good as your last episode. And I just, you know, I don't have to deal with anybody if I just make my own shit and control my own shit. And we'll see what comes from that. And I think... you know, I just want to keep doing what I'm doing and be in a position of, being myself for the rest of my life.
Sounds awesome.
You know?
Well, thanks, Maddie. It's been a real pleasure to have you on Feast Your Ears.
Yeah. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks everybody for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to rate and review the show. And please reach out if you have any questions. You can find me on email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com. And you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community?
rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.